Professor Elbert's class of business organization, 5th November 2008.
Kicks ass. that's Chris Russell. Hi, Chris. Erica Gray, that's you, right? Allison Sablik. Allison and Nate DeCorpo. Okay, good. So all four of you, because it seems like it's a lot when I call on one person and there's a lot of focus on you. We're going to try it this way and see if this gets a little more of a dialogue going. So you four are going to be the primary participants, and then the other 100 million of you are going to join in also. So we'll give it a shot. Okay. I put up a bunch of statutory material on the TWEN site under statutes. Some of the stuff that we're talking about is in our statutory supplement. Some of it isn't. I think it's probably easier for you to just have it online in any event. So you can take a look there. I put up some more slides for the Section 10B stuff that I hope we're going to get to today. We left off last time talking about the concept of a private placement. And that's where I want to start again. Public offerings and private placements are the two ways that you sell securities that are publicly traded. Public offerings go to lots of people. Private placements typically go to a smaller number of people. The reason that we do private placements is because you don't have to fill out the big registration statement. It's a more streamlined, less expensive way to sell shares or to sell securities, I should say. So Section 5 of the 33 Act tells us that you, if you're selling securities in a public offering, you have to register them. That concept makes sense to you guys. We haven't really talked about what registration means yet, but now we know what a security is. So if you sell securities in a public offering, you have to register or you violated Section 5. A carve-out to that is to sell securities not in a public offering, to sell securities in a private placement. And that's where we get into Regulation D, which is the regulation that tells us how to do a private placement. There are three versions, Rule 504, 505, and 506. I put them on TWEN for you. You can take a look at them. All we need to know about these rules is that each rule covers a particular kind of offering. Depending on how much you want to sell and who you want to sell it to, you would figure out what your statistics fit into of these three. There are three separate exemptions. You look at how much you're going to spend or how much you're going to raise, who's going to be investing, and how you plan on getting people to buy the stuff. Typically, the bigger the offering, the more public the advertising and all of that, the more likely it's going to be a public offering. Private placements need to be pretty contained. We talked about the definition of accredited investor, which is a concept that we see a lot in the securities law. The theory behind treating accredited investors differently is the bias that rich people are smart. We all know some rich people that aren't smart. We know some smart people that aren't rich. But a lot of rich people are smart. And for the securities law purposes, keeping in mind what we talked about on Monday, that we want to try to get the protection of this disclosure to the people that need it the most. Maybe the smart rich people don't need it as much as the not so smart, not so rich people. So when we look at Rule 504 and 505, and 506, which are our private placement rules. And it says for 504, you can only have this many offerees. You also get the freebie of accredited investors. So when there's a limitation on the number of people you can offer the security to, they're not counting the accredited investors. You can have as many of those as you want for the most part. Giving me a lot of information about this computer that I don't actually care about right now. What I really care about is this. Because Regulation D private placements are not public offerings, you're not allowed to engage in two concepts, general solicitation and general advertising. Because the whole idea behind the private placement is you're saying to the SEC, we don't need to go to the trouble of registering this offering and doing this giant registration statement. It's just to a couple of people. And then to some extra smart people. If you put it on the radio, and the whole world hears about it, your offerees, the people that you have made that offer to, they did not fix that light, you are kidding me. It's still blinking? Oh, that's so brutal. And I make such a big deal out of it. That is so depressing that the light is not fixed, and it's depressing that they did not take me seriously. Wow. At all. Wow, that is super disappointing. Okay. I'm going to write that down. Very disappointed. 38. Whole class, very disappointed. Okay. I will share our disappointment with the plant department later. Okay. If you engage in general solicitation and general advertising, you run the risk of blowing the exemption. Last time we talked about people that were selling interests that they didn't think were securities. Right? Interest in an orange grove. You didn't think it was a security, so you didn't go through the registration process. Surprise! You get sued. The court say, you know what? Under the Howey test, this is actually a security. You're done. You didn't think it was a security, so it's not like you registered it. Once they prove it's a security, you have violated Section 5. You have sold unregistered securities. Here, we're not having a fight over whether it's a security or not. We didn't register it. We're saying it's a security, absolutely, but we didn't register it because it's not a public offering. It's a private placement. Surprise, if you lose the private placement exemption, then you have sold unregistered securities in a public offering. As we said last time, the burden of proving the exemption is on the person seeking to claim the exemption. So when the company gets sued for a violation of Section 5, which we're going to see comes in Section 12, it's when the shareholder says, you sold the unregistered securities, I'd like my money back, please. And they say, okay, it wasn't a security, we lost on that. It wasn't a public offering, we lost on that. Okay, now we have to give you back your money. When you buy in a private placement, there are resale restrictions on the securities. We call them restricted securities, which makes it sound like you can't do anything with them, but there are a ton of restricted securities, and there are people that trade restricted securities. There's a whole market for it. The idea here is we have carved out of the requirements for the public offering registration this little offering. If they are then allowed to sell them freely to anybody, it's like they've done an end run around the public offering process. There is a cost to selling in a private placement, and the cost is that your securities are restricted. Go back to what we said the other day. There are two ways to avoid registration. To sell a security that is, by its nature, exempt. An exempt security. A security issued by the United States. Exempt, always international, freely trades, never needs to be registered. The other way, this way, an example of this way, is to sell a non-exempt security in an exempt way. And the exempt way is to sell it in a private placement. Make sense? Now, we have spent all of about 10 seconds on Rule 504, 506, 504, 505, and 506. I would not expect a lot on that on the exam, but I'd love you to know that it exists. And we certainly need it to get to our discussion of the Duran case. But before we get there, Regulation D, which is the regulation that the rules come under, 504, 505, and 506, wants to make sure that there are no problematic resales. So in addition to saying we're going to restrict the security, you have to have your purchasers sign letters of investment intent that they're not buying it to resell it, they're buying it to hold it. You have to make sure to legend the securities. We talked about this a couple of classes ago. You type on the front of the stock certificate, this stock was sold in a private placement and was not registered under the 33 Act and cannot be sold without registration. Then you're done. If one of the holders of this chooses to sell it to someone in violation of that, you've done everything you can. If it's not a certificated security, if it's a book entry security that only exists in your corporate, in your computer, you put a hold on it that says this is restricted. So before some random accounts payable person decides to go ahead and do the trade for you, they're stopped from doing it. So you have to take steps to make sure to honor the restricted nature of the stock. Rule 144 is the system for selling restricted stock. When you take securities regulations, you will spend a lot of time on this. When you own restricted stock, you can resell it. You just can't resell it all at once. There are limitations on how much you can sell over time and who you can sell it to. Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about the liabilities, and then we are going to get into our cases. Section 11, we are going to see in the Barkris case. Section 11 is the section of the 33 Act under which we sue people for misleading statements in a registration statement, if you have a materially misleading registration statement. Before the 33 Act was enacted, when somebody sold you securities and there was a problem in the trade, you had to sue for common law fraud. And we remember from contracts, that's kind of a big deal. You got to prove reliance, you got to prove intent, scienter, it was kind of a big deal. These remedies that I'm going to describe for you are very streamlined, which is why people claim that they bought a security, because then they can jump into these nice streamlined remedies. So the couple of statutes we're going to look at, and this really will take us through the end of the semester, Section 11, 12.1 and 12.2 are we're going to talk about right now. 10b and 10b5 we're going to talk about in the second hour and next time, and then the proxy rules we're going to talk about in a class or two after that. Let's start with Section 11. Section 11 is the section you sue under when your registration statement has an untrue statement of material fact. We talked a little bit about the ways that you can have an untrue statement. You can have an affirmative misstatement, a lie, or you can have a material omission. You cannot say something that needed to be said. And then there's that kind of middle ground where you didn't say something that was necessary to make what you said be true, right? So you didn't tell it, you didn't leave something out that was important on its own, but without it, what you said isn't true. So there's sort of that piece of it too. It's always easier to prove the affirmative misrepresentation, right? It's hard to prove that an omission was material. I counted on what I didn't know. That's hard to do. Section 11 is super easy. You show that the registration statement has a material misstatement in it. You can sue everybody who signs the registration statement. Section 6 of the 33 Act tells us who has to sign it. The issuer signs it, and the issuer is the company. They're going to sign it in their corporate capacity. ABC Inc. by Susie Smith, comma, president. She's the agent for the principal corporation, power to bind the corporation. She's not being sued personally. She's being sued in her director capacity. Sorry, her officer capacity. The CEO has to sign, the CFO, the chief financial officer, the chief accounting officer. All the directors are available to be sued, even though not all of them have to sign the registration statement. Only two-thirds of them have to sign the registration statement. And then there's the part of the registration statement that has all the expert opinions. Most of the registration statement, we talked about this the other day, we were talking about what kind of information we would want to have if we were buying stock. We said, we want to know what they're going to spend the money on, who the people are, all of that stuff. In the end of the registration statement, there are expert opinions from lawyers, accountants, investment bankers, and people like that. What might a lawyer say in the end of a registration statement? I want to start with my four people because this is kind of a question you might not have a sense of. Who has an idea of what we might ask of a lawyer with respect to a registration statement? Kate?
Well, I think just to make sure that everything is legally proper and sound.
That's great. She's exactly right. What might be a problem? What if I was selling securities and my certificate of incorporation didn't authorize that number of securities? That's going to be a huge problem, right? So one of the things, the kinds of things we ask the lawyers to opine on, they give a legal opinion. They say, I have read everything about this deal. It is my legal opinion, based on my knowledge of the state of New York's laws, that these securities, when issued, will be validly issued, fully paid, non-assessable. I see no legal reason this transaction can't go forward. Nobody has a claim. No governmental authority needs to weigh in on this. So you're not opining as to matters of fact. You're only opining as to matters of law. What's the accountant going to say? My accountant friend in the back, what's the accountant going to say? Tell us what that means. He's going to say, I looked at the financial statements, and yep, that actually is what the company's got going on. Based on what they, and we're going to carve out, when you guys get into practice, You will learn how to write a legal opinion. The opinion is one sentence long, and the backup and weaseling out and justifications and all that stuff is like two more pages. Because I'm going to say, based on what the clients gave me, I'm happy to say what I know about New York law, but I don't want to get into factual issues. I'm going to say, based on what the clients have told me, this is my opinion. The accountant's going to do the same thing. Unless they actually prepare the statements, they're going to say, I've reviewed these financial statements, they are in the proper form, there's no problem with them, and they accurately represent the picture, the financial picture of the company. Remember when we looked at the estoppel, the partnership by estoppel case with the company in the Bahamas with, what was it? Not Ernst & Young. Pricewaterhouse. And the investor was suing the accountants because she relied on their clean audit letter. That's the kind of thing that we're going to stick in the registration statement. Because one of the big parts of the registration statement is going to be the financial statements. Before we decide that we want to buy into this company, we want to know how they're doing. The underwriters are going to talk about, they're the investment bankers, they're going to talk about how the stock is being priced. And we call that a fairness opinion. Now, each one of those experts is only giving their opinion in their area of expertise. So when you sue under Section 11, you can sue all the people on the list, but you only sue the lawyers if the misstatement is in the legal opinion. You only sue the accountants if the misstatement is in the audit letter. You only sue the investment bankers or the underwriter if the misstatement is in the fairness opinion. Right? So the company is on the hook for the whole thing because it's their book. They're the ones that are selling the securities. They wrote it. It's their company. They have liability for every word in there. The experts come in and have to vouch for their part of it. Section 11 is much broader than common law fraud. All you have to show is two things. You bought in the offering, and there's a material misrepresentation. You don't have to show scienter, that it was intentional. You don't have to show causation, that you read it and that's the reason you decided to rely on it. And you don't have to show that you relied on it. That's much easier than common law fraud. This is why people want to have what they purchased be characterized as a security. The statute limits damages to the total amount of the offering. There are circumstances under which your damages might be more than the total value of the offering. It seems unlikely, but it's possible. But that's the cap. And then the statute tells us how to figure out what the damages are. How do we get out of Section 11? What kind of defenses should be raised in Section 11? Well, if you're being sued for a material misstatement in a registration statement, the first thing I'm going to say is it's not a misstatement. You're wrong. It's true. Okay, I lose on that. I say, okay, rats. Turns out it's a misstatement. However, it's not material. It's a generic, non-important fact. It was not material. If I lose on that, I'm going to have a problem. When Section 11 is triggered and people are being sued, the defenses that the defendants have depend on who they are to the company. Issuers have strict liability, for the most part, on their registration statement, which is not, it shouldn't be surprising to you. It's their registration statement. They are running the company, they wrote it, they hired the lawyers, they reviewed everything, they are not getting off the hook. The only possibility for an issuer to be able to successfully defend a valid Section 11 claim is if you can show the purchaser knew about the omission when they bought the security. It's hard to prove, but that should make sense to you. If you bought it, if you knew about the misstatement and bought it anyway and sued, you were buying a lawsuit. And that's not interesting. If it's not material, you're going to win, or if the statute of limitations has run. So for the most part, issuers have liability. Assuming that the claim is brought in a timely fashion, assuming the misstatement or omission is in fact material, and assuming there's no evidence that you knew about it before you bought it, the issuer is going to be liable. May turn out to be an uninteresting defendant. They may not have any money, because if you have a problem with it, the rest of your fellow shareholders are going to have a problem with it. If you are not the issuer, you have other possible defenses. You have to show that you are not negligent, And you have to, when you find out about this misstatement, resign from your role in the company or take steps to resign, alert the SEC, alert the issuer, and give reasonable public notice. It's almost a whistleblower type requirement. So once the lawsuit starts brewing, everybody starts resigning, and all that's left is the company. The due diligence defense that we're going to see tried in Barcrest is the most popular defense attempted, not always successful. This defense gets you off the hook if two things are true. You had reasonable grounds to believe there was no omission or misstatement, and you did, in fact, believe there was no omission or misstatement. Why do we need both of those pieces? Who's got a thought on that? Chris, what do you think about that? Why do we need both of those? Should it be enough that I said I didn't believe there was an omission?
No, I think by just stating that, I mean, one is a lot better than the issues. It's easy to help.
Right. So it's pretty self-serving. What does the first piece of it do? Require reasonable grounds for the belief.
It helps establish more money.
I think that's exactly right. Does that make sense to you guys? That there's no more self-serving standard if your defense was to say, I didn't think it was a misstatement. Guess what? Everyone's going to say that. But if we need reasonable grounds to believe that, what does that sound like that we talked about from 141? What does that sound like? Does it sound like 141E where they rely on the expert's advice? It's the same kind of concept. What we're saying to directors and officers is, we're going to hold you liable if you're a moron, right? But if some smart people tell you things and it seems reasonable, we're going to try to give you some cover. So it's not that you didn't think there was a misstatement or omission, but in addition, it was reasonable for you to think that. So we get into the context of it. So you can imagine everybody wants to use the due diligence defense. And the standard we use to evaluate that reasonable belief is we look at the level of care a prudent person would exercise if their own money was at stake. Our theory being that people are going to be much more careful with their own money. The court puts everything in context. They look at the defendant's knowledge, the defendant's expertise, how close they are to the issuer. Think back to our LLC case where that guy was the treasurer, he was on the executive board, the CFO reported to him. He's someone who would have a hard time explaining why he didn't know that a misstatement of a financial nature, in this case, was there. We look to see how much the defendant participated in the process. So this defense works for people that are a little bit removed. An independent director on the board who reviewed a couple of drafts, right, and listened to some presentations and asked some questions, so we don't have a duty of care issue, and let's say we don't have a duty of loyalty issue, and it turns out there were things that were wrong. It's almost 141E-ish in its concept that he then gets to, or she then gets to say, you know what, I wasn't involved in the day-to-day, but the CFO who was writing the prospectus, who was writing the registration statement, is going to have a much higher burden to show that they get a due diligence defense. Another way you can sue is under Section 12. Section 12.1 is the gun-jumping statute. That's what we call it when you sell securities in violation of Section 5. Carrie, do you have a question about 11?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a little confused, you know, like I understand what an issuer is, but in the context of a corporation, is everybody there considered
the issuer? The issuer is the corporation itself, right? So it's one of these weird things where the corporation exists legally, but it doesn't exist physically. So issuer is the language that we use, the word terminology we use for the corporation when we're talking about selling securities. So the issuer signs the registration statement, ABC Inc., by Carrie as president. You don't have liability. you're a director and an officer, but there you're signing in your officer capacity, binding the company. The company is being sued. The company's not always an interesting defendant, and as long as you're suing, let's include everybody. Section 11 says, have a nice day. Put anybody who signed the registration statement on the hook. And then they begin to weasel out one by one.
So for the non-issuer defendants, would that be everybody else?
That is directors, officers, accountants, that's everybody who's not the corporation. Right? The corporation is the one that's raising the money. The corporation / issuer is the one who hired all the experts and hired the folks that wrote the book. Right? They have responsibility. They're the ones that are going to use the money. So they have very limited defenses to get off. But like I said, they turn out not to always be such excellent defendants. They usually run out of money. 12-1 is the one that focuses on gun jumping, when you sell securities in violation of Section 5. So 12A1 is the statute you sue under when you have purchased securities that were unregistered. So if you go back to the cases we were talking about Howie yesterday, when you sue for failure to tell the information about the orange groves, step one is show that it's a security under the Act. Step two is show that it was unregistered. Step three, get your money back. It is that simple. It is essentially a put, meaning it's a forced sale back. It's a rescission of the purchase contract. So it's civil liability for folks that violate Section 5. Let's think about who violates Section 5. Nobody wakes up and says, oh my God, today I'm going to violate Section 5. This is going to be great. I'm going to sell unregistered securities. Let's see what happens. That's not how it works. What happens is people sold things that they didn't think were securities, right? Or they sold it in what they thought was an exempt way. So when we have the violations of Section 5, it's people who either didn't think it was a security or thought they had it covered and lost an exemption. You need privity here. You need a direct link with the seller. So only folks that bought in that offering, not subsequent resellers, subsequent purchasers, can have the put. And you have a time limit. The issuer, we're picking on the issuer now, right? The issuer has a fraudulent statement. The issuer has misstatements. The issuer also, I was going to say the issuer needs to sleep at night. The issuer is an entity that doesn't sleep. But the issuer needs some closure, to use that awful word. The issuer needs to know that at some point there will be no litigation. So when the statute is run and 3 years have come and gone, that issue is closed. It's too late to bring an unregistered securities lawsuit. 12-2 picks up where Section 11 ends. It's a little more complicated, and it's an express remedy if there is a misstatement or omission in prospectus. You have to show the sale of the security, that you used interstate commerce or U.S. mail to buy it, that there was a prospectus or it was orally communicated to you. Again, you have to show the material misstatement or omission. And here we have a scienter-like requirement. The defendant needs to have privity and needed to know that they know or should have known that there was the untrue statement. Just like with Section 11, you can't have known about the misstatement or omission when you bought the security, and this one has a 1-year statute of limitations. Okay, so now we know a little bit about some of these remedies. That make sense? That was clear? Yeah? All right, let's talk about Duran, and let's start with Erica. Tell us about Mr. Duran's background and how he comes into business with the Petroleum Management Company.
Corporation, I think that drilled oil. And then he said, to complete the partnership, I'll give you $125,000. And then he put down a certain amount of money, $5,000. And then another partner was like, that's fine, but you need to take over this note. And Duran was like, okay, I'll take over this note. But something happened with Duran's business, and so he couldn't don't even know anymore. So then,
that's what stopped there. That's good. I like how you did it like a little skit. You gave everybody like, Duran says this, and he did. He was upset. He was unhappy. He buys into this thing. He decides to pay with money, and he decides to pay by taking on liability. Does it make sense that it adds value to the issuer if an investor agrees to take over a debt that the issuer owes? It's not cash in, but it is value. That has value. Tell me about Mr. Duran's background. What do we know about him?
I have a question.
Okay.
If you take over a note, is that necessarily like a debt security kind of, or is it more of
a... You're not buying a security, you are guaranteeing somebody else's. It depends how you do it. There are two ways you can do it. I can pay your debt for you, and I can take it, but then you need to know that. I need the creditor to agree to hold me responsible, not you, or I can agree to guarantee it. I can become liable along with you on the note. Okay? Tell us a little bit about Duran's background. What do we know about Mr. Duran?
He knew something about $2 million.
How do you know that? I'm looking for it. I know he had some kind of degree, right? Don't we know that? I feel like he's like a... Right?
Is he working on it?
Who remembers what he does? He's got a, yeah.
He has a petroleum engineering degree.
That's what I was going for. He has a petroleum engineering degree. Does anyone in this room have a petroleum engineering degree? No, that sounds pretty fancy. You're pointing to him. Chris has one? No? Okay, because that would be weird. We would have an expert. So, sophistication. The reason I raise this is sophistication is a relative term. This is an oil production issue. His petroleum background makes sense. So sophistication is not measured in terms of the need for disclosure, is not measured in a vacuum. It's measured as applied to a particular investment opportunity. So he's starting to sound like he has the right background for this. Okay. Allison, who, how many people did they contact to get this thing going? 8 people. Now how many people bought? Okay, so we have 8 offerees and 1 purchaser. When we're counting noses in this area, we count the offerees. It's not who buys and whose check clears. It's who you made a binding offer to. That's the relevant number. So the more offerees you have, the less likely it is to be a private placement. So he pays $25,000, and then he agrees to be liable on one of the notes to the tune of $113,000. He's going to be liable instead of the corporation. So in essence, he has put in $113,000 worth of value because he took over that debt. How is the partnership doing when first we met Mr. Duran?
At first, I think it was doing pretty well, but then they started overproducing.
I feel like the timing on that's not quite. I feel like they were doing well because they were overproducing. And then when the government said, no more, please don't do that, and they said, okay, and then they did more, and then the government came and shut it down. So they, when they had to stick within the legal limits, it turned out they weren't doing so well. Okay. They start losing money, and they default on the note that he's guaranteed. So now the creditor is coming to him and saying, they won't pay, you've signed, we'd like $113,000, please. And he says what, Allison? What is his cause of action?
He is trying to rescind the contract based on the fact that the petroleum company violated the securities laws to be offered as a partnership.
Exactly right. Let's be a little more specific. What section is he suing as a violation of? What is he saying they didn't do? Before we get to stack for it, what is it, in English, what's he saying they didn't do?
That they didn't register
the securities. So he's suing for a violation of Section 5. He says, A, he said you sold the unregistered securities. We know the threshold issue is, did they in fact sell them the securities? That's where we're going to start. Do you think they in fact sold them the securities? Nate, what do you think?
Well, I think they sold the securities.
Yes.
Well, it could be
great idea.
Well, it was that he was able to control his investments. It's really what characterizes him as a security or not.
Let's go through all three of the elements. What do we need? What's the first element of Howie?
Building control.
That's the investment of money. Let's start with that. Can you invest money?
Yes.
Okay, now, when I said investment of money, I misspoke a little bit. If all we did was guarantee the note, that would probably be enough. Because that's consideration for contracts, right? He happened to have given 25 grand and guaranteeing the note. So let's say this is your exam question. You would say, the first question we have to look at is whether this is in fact a security under the federal securities laws. Now it requires the following three things: investment of money, common enterprise, profits derived predominantly from the efforts of others. So I've given you a conclusion, I've given you a rule, now my application. In this case, he invested money because he paid $25,000. There's horizontal commonality. Why do we have horizontal commonality? Do we have horizontal commonality?
Yeah, he assumed the risk of the enterprise by taking on that liability.
So if there's only one investor, is horizontal commonality satisfied? Do we need more than one investor? There were other people in the partnership, so there were other investors. You can't do it alone. So then you would have too much control. And then the third piece that you're talking about, whether he had the ability to control or whether his profits predominantly came from his own efforts or someone else's. It's not a great set of facts for Howie, but if you look at the bottom of 424, the district court in footnote 4, the district court correctly concluded that the limited partnership interest was a security, as that term is defined in the Securities Act of 33 and the Securities Act of 34. If I gave you a Howie question, I would give you so many more facts. It was hard for me. We didn't really have enough on the common enterprise thing. It was a little hard. Like, he knew the test. We knew the money. We don't really know what his interests are, where the profits are coming from. So it's nice that they give us that summary in the footnote. It's not supported in our version of the case. You have to look at the district court version. But I don't want you guys to lose sight of, as we talk about whether we have a Section 5 claim or not, that the underlying threshold issue is this even a security? Because if it isn't a security, Mr. Duran goes back to state court to sue for common law fraud. Okay? All right. So he's suing for Section 5 to get his money back. This is either a private placement or it is a public offering. The court goes through a couple of different factors that help us figure out whether it's a private placement. Nate, what do you think about the number of offerees and the relationship to the issuer? Why would this help us figure out if something was a private placement or a public offering?
Well, just at first glance, you could decide whether there's enough people to make it public or private. Here, Dean is kind of like in the gray area, I think, depending on the type of investment that was offered, it could go either way. But I believe the court says that he would be taking with the offering, with the private placement offering.
That A was too many.
Yeah.
It's funny because, does it make sense to you guys that the smaller number of offerings the better, and the smaller dollar amount the better? That said, we could come up with a fact pattern where, and there are private placements that go to 35 people. So eight is a big number, it's a big small number. But the number of offerees is not dispositive. If it's more than what the statute requires, you're going to have a problem. But as long as you're within the statutory limitations, Eight doesn't really help us too much. How about the relationship to each other and to the issuer? What part of Howie does that go to? How does that help us figure out who needs the protection of the securities laws, Nate?
Well, I guess, you know, how savvy the investors are and whether they are in a position to know if this is a private placement or a public offering would tell you whether they should know, I guess.
Why do we care about the relationship to the issuer? What is that, Erica? What does that have to do with anything?
It would go back to whether the law should be protecting them.
I think that's right. If someone is deeply involved in the issuer versus somebody who is a passive investor who knows nothing about it, the passive investor arguably needs the disclosure. So when I say the protection of the securities laws, the litigator part of me means 11 and 12 and suing them, but what the corporate lawyer in me means, are they getting the information they need, the disclosure? So a passive investor who is new to the company versus an internal investor who has been running the enterprise, that person arguably needs less protection. So we want to take a look at his connection to the company and his level of sophistication. The number of units offered, again, smaller is better, but it's not going to be dispositive. The size of the offering speaks to the dollar amount that you're trying to raise. And just like we said with the number of offerees, it's not dispositive, but there is a dollar amount that's going to be too big. There's a dollar amount that a court's going to look at and say, I don't care how many people you're offering it to, that's public. And the manner of offering looks to the idea of general solicitation and advertising, which are two prohibited things in the context of private placements. The court tells us the most critical factor and the most conceptually problematic for this defendant is the first one, the number of offerees and the relationship to the enterprise. Here, the number of offerees allows us to figure out how big the offering is and try to figure out who the offerees are, what their connection is to the company. As we just said, the number is not dispositive, but it's hard to overcome the presumption that a big number of offerees tends to be more likely to be considered a public offering. Why do we care about offerees? I think we talked about this last time. It's about the process. It's not about who ultimately buys. It's a public offering, not a public sale that we're concerned about. It is what is going out to the world. The theory being that if it's a public offering, before you say yes or no, you have the information you need to say yes or no. So the important thing to remember when we're counting noses here is to keep in mind that it's the offerees, not the ultimate buyers. And we want them to be sophisticated because then we worry less that they need the protection and the information from the securities laws. When you have somebody like Duran that was very inside the company, he had access to much of the information that he would have gotten in the registration statement. That's going to cut against him versus a passive investor who had no ability to get that information. All right, what else do I want to say about Duran? So ultimately, Nate, how does the court find? Is it a private placement or a public offering?
Oh, it is a public offering.
And what did they do with it?
They send it back so that it's tried as a section 5.
They want to see if there's any evidence that the offerees had comparable information to what they would have gotten under a registration. So it's reversed. It's not a private placement, and the court focuses very much on the fact that these guys, the offerees, this guy in particular, Duran, had the information necessary to evaluate the limited partnership interests. The court says, in the absence of findings of fact that each offeree had been furnished information about the issuer that a registration statement would have disclosed. See, that makes them whole. If they had the information they were going to get in the registration statement, there's no problem. The district court erred in concluding it was a private placement, finding that some of these offerees, remember there were seven other offerees who may have been unconnected to the company, and they were entitled to that information. All right, let's take our break. We're going to come back, and that worked with the four people, right? That was better? Or you like one at a time? I like four better. Why am I asking you? We're going to do it my way anyway. Okay, after the break, we'll have four new friends and talk about Escott versus Barkas.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Hi, you're Mark?
Yes.
How are you? Good?
Good.
Your fun fact is that you live at home with your parents. I'm never letting my daughter leave me, so I think that's terrific. She's going to stay with me always. We have Chris Rogers. Who's Chris Rogers? Hi, Chris. You're a Robert Moses lifeguard? That's sort of cool. Yeah, I was a lifeguard in a pool. That's as much as I could do. So I'm a little swimming in the ocean now. Sarah Crabtree. Oh my God, it's all this side of the room. Sarah's been to the Galapagos. Good. And Eric Dantes. So how you say, oh, you're Eric. You used to build houses. Yeah. I like a hard net. I could do that. I did Habitat for Humanity once, but they wanted me to get too high up and too out on the thing. It was not interesting. I like the ground. I like to help people on the ground, primarily. All right, you four. And I think this is going to work. I realize the rest of you are not going to pay attention at all, because now you know I'm not going to call it. But I know that at least four of you are good. And now everyone else can, you know, we'll give it a shot. Everything's a work in progress, guys. The big class is just trying to find ways to engage you. Okay. Marcus is a sad tale of the bowling alley gone awry. Patch's party, as you know, this year was at a bowling alley, so I'm sensitive to the bowling alley issues. Let's start with Eric, and why don't you tell us a little bit about how Barcris, when they would build their bowling alleys, how would they finance them? Why did they need to go to the market so much?
They need to go to the market because they're going through a period of rapid expansion, and they weren't taking costs as fast as they were expanding. And so they need to go to the market to raise capital.
I think that's exactly right. Do any of your colleagues of my four have a sense of how they finance their bowling alleys? And again, this might not be in the full opinion, but they did a lot of, it's like a sale leaseback. They would enter into contracts with customers and take a small down payment. They would build the bowling alley, and then the customer would pay for it at the end. Can you think of anything better for the customer? Can you think of anything more taxing for the enterprise? So they're front-loading all the costs of being paid back in the end. So they had cash flow crunches. They had money that was coming in, but they had to spend money in order to get that money. So they wound up laying out a lot of construction costs before they were reimbursed. Their first offering to the public is common stock. Very common. Sorry, I almost said that. Very typical that your first public offering is common stock. Sometimes it's bonds, but usually it's common stock. So they do a common stock offering. They need more money. This time they sell debentures. Remember what debentures are? Debt instruments, typically unsecured debt instruments. They need more. They go back to the market. They file for another common stock offering, but they wind up abandoning that offering and filing for bankruptcy. And then they default on the publicly traded debentures. Okay. What are convertible subordinated debentures? Look how much we learned in a week. Convertible means they can be turned into something else, typically common stock. We might not have learned subordinated. Does that concept make sense? Any of my four have a sense of what subordinated means? No? Yes, go ahead.
Not priority.
Exactly right. They are not in the priority position. That happened. He said it like it was a smart answer, but like he was being a wise guy, but it's actually right. It means that they are not in a priority position. They are paid after something else. They are sub. They are subordinated to something else. Unsecured debt instruments, they're not in priority. Oh, you said that because it was on the slide. You were being That's funny. That's funny. That's no walk on the beach by my Gemini. That's funny. Okay. Every day is good. Okay. Why are they suing? Maybe these slides are too instructive. Let me take a look. They're suing under Section 11. We remember from earlier, Section 11 means there's something wrong with the registration statement. You've got to show you bought the offering and there's something wrong. It needs to be a material misstatement. So we're going to take a look at what was the material false statement? What was it about?
It was that they misrepresented their numbers and they had more money than they did and probably less than they did.
So they misrepresented their financial conditions. Would you say that's material to a potential investor?
Yes.
Why?
It's going to change your decision on whether you want to invest in a company that's less assets.
Or it also may change not only whether you want to invest, but how much you'd be willing to spend. right? It may change the pricing of it. The idea of the securities laws are we give the investors all of this information that's not fraudulent. And then we let them make a decision, and we hope that it's an informed decision. I'm sure they send you the same stuff they send me, the proxy statements that I put into the garbage. I wrote them for 7 years. I agonized over every line. Somebody wrote that, and I just don't care. I don't have time to read it. I'm not going to vote. I'm not sending the proxy card in. I am an apathetic shareholder. That's just my lot in life. Here, we have a different situation. We have a shareholder who is unhappy about the prospectus, about the registration statement, and has found an error. So we're suing under Section 11, and who do they sue? Sarah, who do they sue?
Everyone.
And who is everyone?
The director.
Yep. They always see the issuer, right? You always see the issuer.
The issuer, yes. The underwriter, the accountant, the
controller. Good. So they're going to sue the issuer. Does it make sense if the issuer filed for bankruptcy and that if you get a judgment against them, you're at the end of a very long line? So that's not going to be an interesting defendant to you. The directors individually, keeping in mind what we talked about earlier, the idea of the due diligence defense. We're going to have to take a close look at these directors, what their connections are to the company, to try to figure out whether they can say the two grounds. What were the two grounds? I had a reasonable basis to believe that there was no misstatement, and I did believe there was no misstatement. If the misstatement is, as Mark tells us, if the misstatement is what Mark tells us, financial in nature, the controller who does the money is going to have a hard time with the due diligence defense, right? Because he's in charge of the money piece of it. All right, so let's take a look at who these defendants are and try to figure out whether it makes sense to sue them and whether they should have a defense. The issuer is liable because he signs the registration statement. We're going to look for a due diligence defense for everybody else. What do you think? Did the registration statement in fact contain false statements? Mark tells us it did, and I think he's right. They misrepresented the financial statement. That's clearly a misstatement. It is material. We're going to spend a lot of time next class starting to flesh out the case law test for what is material. We have a sense of it, right? If they said that the CEO is 61 and he's 62, well, let's not make him that old. They said he's 41, not 42. Probably not going to be material. It's probably not material if he's 61 or 62. If they had the wrong graduation date from somebody's college, probably not material. If they misstate earnings, probably material. So we're going to figure out what is the difference between those two kinds of statements. Okay, so who are our defendants? Vitolo is the president and Puglis is the vice president. Eric, what do you think about these guys, president and vice president? What is their argument?
The argument is that
Chris?
They had no education.
They said, we're the president and the vice president, but we're super dumb. We're running this company, but look what a bad job we did. We're filing bankruptcy. We are just so dumb. And the court says, thanks for sharing. That happens to be irrelevant on a due diligence defense. Did you believe that there was a misstatement? And do you have a misstatement? And do you have a reasonable belief? So this is like Mrs. Francis, right? Or not Mrs. Francis. In Francis versus United Jersey Bank. I can't remember her name. It's Mrs. Pritchard, I think was her name. The woman who was old and drunk and never went to be a director. And then she said, I'm old and drunk. I just don't know how to do anything. They said, we are so dumb that we just really can't be held responsible. If you're that dumb, you shouldn't have agreed to take on the presidency and the vice presidency of this company. They should have hired lawyers to represent themselves. So does it make sense that the due diligence defense is not going to be available to these two characters? Mr. Kircher, who is the treasurer, the court doubts almost everything he says and makes it seem like he was purposely feeding wrong information. Mr. Birnbaum is a director. The sad part about Mr. Birnbaum is he's like a 2 year out of law school. He is you guys, right? He is a brand new baby lawyer and had no business being given this kind of task without supervision. He didn't investigate the accuracy of the registration statement, and since he didn't investigate the accuracy, he loses the due diligence defense. It's not just
just that he didn't think it was a misstatement. He has to have a reasonable basis for it. And if he said, I read the registration statement, and I checked out the following 10 things, and that's why I thought it was true, he has shown that he had a reasonable basis for believing it and did believe it. If he just believed there was no misstatement, without that reasonable basis, he loses the defense. Auslander is an outside director. He signed the registration statement without knowing what was in it. He was in our best position to have a due diligence defense, right? Because he has the lowest threshold. He's not connected to the company. But when he got up in court and said, I actually never read it, I just signed it. And then they said, well, you actually need a reasonable basis for your belief that there was no misstatement. He's like, okay, let me back that up. He was in trouble because he admitted that he never read it. And then Grant, who is the outside counsel, was also a director. What do you think about him in this dual capacity? Who do I need? I need Chris. What do you think about that?
Well, this one of the things that Bill was asking, I would even have to be more aware of his role to what's coming, because he has to wear both hats, and that should be put in a rest of more material than maybe his reasonable belief, I think, is, I don't want to say a high reasonable belief, but he should be more apt to know what that's going on.
It's going to be harder for him to say I had a reasonable basis to believe this thing was wrong because of his role. Yeah.
I have a question about Auslander.
Yeah.
How would they, like, let's say he has Auslander and says he read the statement, he read what he was supposed to read. And, I mean, how do they prove that he didn't?
He said he didn't read it. Okay, then if your question is, it's an affirmative defense, so he has to prove the defense, right? So he has to show two things. That it's easy for him to say, I didn't think there were any misstatements. I read the thing, it looked good to me. Then we need to explore, to give him the defense, what is reasonable that underlies that. Well, the financial statements were wrong. What made you think they weren't wrong? What did you do? What was the basis for that? And if he said, the accountants came and made a presentation, I asked the following three questions, they seemed to know what they were talking about, that's why I think it harkens back to 141E. It's the same vibe for me. It's a director or an officer saying, I was careful, I'm not reinventing the wheel, we hired somebody who told me something and I relied on it reasonably. That's the concept. His goose is cooked because he got on the stand and said he didn't read it. Because he thought then they would say, okay, well then you don't have any responsibility. And the court said, in fact, you shouldn't have signed it then under those circumstances. How about Pete Marwick? Anyone have a problem with holding them responsible? What do you think? Chris, what do you think about Pete Marwick?
I don't have a problem with holding them responsible at all. They were considered the experts in this area.
They also sent a brand new baby accountant. So this was a bunch of old bowling alley executives who couldn't keep the business operated, and two young whippersnappers. And this guy, you can imagine, you guys will have this in your law firms. You have questions in your head. Even in a classroom like this with somebody like me, sometimes you don't want to raise your hand and ask a question because you don't want it to appear that you have issues, that you have questions, and you'll come to me afterwards. You're in a boardroom with a bunch of people that sign your paycheck, and it's your first year. There's a lot of pressure on you to kind of go with it. You're not going to raise your hand and say, I'm sorry, did anyone go over these financials? They just don't look right to me. I've been practicing law for almost a month now, and I really have a very strong view about this. They sent the poor little accountant, and then he took everybody at their word. He said to the bar press guys, did you look at the numbers? They said, yeah, they look good to me, son. Now, the question is, did they know they were cooking the books? Of course they did. Of course they did. And they're going to have other litigation later on. But the securities litigation stems from selling to the public securities based on a fraudulent document. It's a very particular kind of liability. They have all kinds of other liability, but this is a way for the shareholders to get their money back in a nice streamlined process. The court tells us with respect to damages that you can limit your damages by showing that the losses came from something else other than the misstatements. So it's not a slam dunk that you show that there's a misstatement in the registration statement and you win. If they can show that the damages that the plaintiff got or the plaintiff incurred came from other factors, you can back that out of the damages a little bit. The way to think about that is, if the misstatements are material, it's going to bear on the price of the securities. So you paid more for it than you would have paid for it. So that you can start to look at the damages in that regard. Okay. A couple more points on once you've gone public, what happens? And then we're going to take a look at 10b-5. Victor told us the other day, much to my dazzlement and impressed, I was so impressed that he knew what a Form S-1 was. Maybe some of you guys did too. I sure didn't when I was in law school. But it's a registration form that you use for a public offering. It is the comprehensive, detailed, most burdensome form. You use it when you have to. S2, S3, S4, all the other registration forms are easier to deal with, but they only apply to particular populations. So if you can't fit into any of those, you got to do an S1. But if you can find a way to use one of the easier forms, you will. Everybody does an S1 on that first public offering. It tells the market everything about the company. Because remember, this company was not publicly traded before. Nobody had any information on the people, on the finances, and now all of a sudden, the market has public information on the last 5 years of financials and the last 5 years of operations and plans going forward. So now the market has a lot of information. Once you have sold securities in a public offering, you are required to participate in this process called the Integrated Disclosure System. So that means you have to keep updating the market at least every quarter. I put on TWEN for you, at least I hope I did. I was very unsuccessful with the slides, but I'm hopeful that in the statute, there's actually the statute tab, there are actions from statutes, but I will take a look into that. You don't need to look now. I don't even want to brought up. Don't even look now. The disclosure requirements are that every quarter you file something called a Form 10-Q that says, "Dear World, here are our quarterly statements. They're unaudited, but we're pretty sure they're right," for 3 quarters. On that last quarter, you file an annual report on 10-K that says, "Here are audited statements. Here's everything that happened to us. It has a lot of the same information that we had in the public offering document in the S-1, but it's updated." So the company information is always current. The only other form I put on there is the Form 8K, which is the one that you use for out-of-the-ordinary things, right? Every quarter you update, a quarter's a long time. It's 3 months. Things may happen. CEO drops dead. You announce a merger. Big ticket items, you're going to throw an 8K out there and tell the market about it. So the S1 is the most detailed set of instructions, and it's for initial public offerings and for anyone who cannot fit into any of the other forms. The S2, nobody really uses. It was the right idea. It's for seasoned companies that have been reporting for 3 years. So you can't use it until 3 years from your first public offering have elapsed. All of these later forms have that same idea. Once you have been a reporting company, a publicly traded company, making these information reports for X period of time, when you go to register an offering, all you have to do is tell the market about the offering. The market already knows all about you because they had your initial public offering, and every quarter they got updates, and every year they got a big book, so they know everything that's going on. They just need to know about these particular securities. So that's why the registration statements for subsequent public offerings don't require as much information. And they're smaller because you can cross-reference. You can say, you're asking me about the directors. Take a look at my 10-K from last year. There's a nice description there. Take a look here. It's all public. So it winds up being a much more streamlined process. S3 is the one that most folks use when you've been reporting for a year and you're in good standing with the SEC, you can do subsequent offerings on this nice streamlined form. Form 10 is the form that you file after you go public for the first time to register your class of securities. 10-K, I just told you about, that's the annual report. 10-Q and 8-K are the other forms. Okay, so if you take a look at those forms, I think it will be illustrative for you, because if you get into any sort of corporate practice, you are absolutely going to be involved in that. Who's got a question about this before we press on to a discussion about Section 10B? Everyone's feeling pretty good? You all want to be corporate lawyers and do securities work? Perfect. Perfect. Sounds like with this market, we're all going to do bankruptcy work, but that's all right. You'll have a nice background from corporate. They'll just slot you right into bankruptcy, and when the market picks up, back to corporate. Okay, Section 10B is our federal anti-fraud statute. It's the most important anti-fraud statute in the federal securities laws. We're going to see it a lot in the next couple of classes. What the statute tells you is that you cannot use manipulative or deceptive devices in the purchase or sale of a security. Keeping in mind, when we're talking about securities for purposes of 10B, we're talking about securities within the statutory definition. So if you're not a stock, a bond, a debenture, a note, an investment contract under Howey, you have no 10B opportunities. You have no 10B liability as a defendant, and you have no 10B cause of action as a plaintiff. The statute tells us it's unlawful to use interstate commerce or the mails to use or employ, in connection with the purchase or sale of a registered security or an unregistered security. So it's on a national exchange or not. So it's public and private. 10B is for all securities. You can't use any manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance in contravention of the rules that we're going to make up. So 10B doesn't have any teeth. 10B says you better not do it, and we're going to give you some rules. The rules show up in Rule 10b-5, and the way the 34 Act works is, sorry, the 33 Act works, is that we have sections with numbers, and then we have rules that correspond to the numbers, so it's pretty easy to find them. Rule 10b-5 is the rule that gives teeth to Section 10b. Doesn't seem to give too much teeth, but the case law really helps us. It says you can't employ a device, scheme, or artifice to defraud. The part that people really sue on, 10b-5b, you cannot make any untrue statement of material fact or omit to state a material fact necessary in order to make the statements made in light of the circumstances under which they're made not misleading. God, what a mouthful, right? They're saying don't lie and don't omit something that makes what you said a lie. There are things that you can omit that are material because they would have an effect on what you did say. And you can't engage in a practice of deceit. You can't do any of that in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. A 10b-5 cause of action has a couple of different elements. There's a jurisdictional nexus. There's a transactional nexus. You need to show the material misrepresentation or the material omission. You need to prove reliance, and you need to prove causation and scienter. Reliance and causation in this area get a little bit overlapped, as we'll see, and we're going to use our doctrine fraud on the market that's going to help get us over some of that. With respect to the jurisdictional nexus, this used to be a huge deal, guys, and now it's really not. It's not impossible. It's highly unlikely that you could buy or sell securities that didn't use interstate commerce or the mails, right? But in 1929, the mails, interstate commerce, that's a big deal. Now you have the internet, it's almost impossible to not satisfy the jurisdictional nexus. The transactional nexus focuses on the bad behavior occurring in connection with the buying and selling of a security. So it's not bad behavior in a vacuum. It's fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of a security as defined under the federal laws. It has to be a material fact that you state or omit. You want to show that a reasonable investor would consider it to be important. If you would consider it to be important, it would bear on whether you wanted to buy it, and if you wanted to buy it, how much you wanted to pay for it, which takes us to the idea of causation. Now, what's the danger in setting a standard for materiality? Because that's what we're going to see in these cases. Sarah, what do you think about that? I think that's exactly right. What happens if we set the standard too high and make materiality this giant standard?
Then there could be security fraud that doesn't fit in, but have the effect of security fraud and the policy really wouldn't be something
that they're trying to perform. I think that's exactly right. If we set materiality too high, stuff that is problematic for us would be under it. If we set it too low, then they're going to have to, they're going to be lawsuits about every ridiculous thing. You have to find the balance with materiality, and I'm using the word balance intentionally, because when we get through the Basic versus Levinson case, we'll see that we come up with a balancing test. Because that's what you're really trying to figure out. Materiality is not a scientific fact. You have to look at the context, look at the investors, look at the circumstance, and try to figure out whether a reasonable investor would have considered it important in making the purchase decision. What's hard is the people that say, I would have bought it, but. Those are people we have a little trouble helping. We can help people that did buy it, but it's hard because as soon as something goes on, everybody says, well, I would have bought it. That's going to be harder for us to deal with. We have to show reliance, and this is a complicated piece of this. We have to show a connection between the defendant's misrepresentation and the plaintiff's injury. The Supreme Court said that if we can show a breach of a duty to disclose material information, that will satisfy reliance. If we can show the defendant had a duty to disclose material information and did not do so, it's almost that we're going to read in the concept of reliance there. Reliance is what trips up plaintiffs, because you have to show this misstatement was a big deal to me, I believed it, and that's why I bought the security. That's going to be hard to show. The reliance test looks at affirmative misrepresentations and omissions differently. It's super hard to show that you relied on an omission. Just think about that for a second, right? It's easier, it's complicated to show you relied on a misstatement. It's really hard to prove that you relied on an omission. So the courts tend to put in a rebuttable presumption on omissions. Absent proof to the contrary, the plaintiff is presumed to have relied. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about fraud on the market. And let's go back to Mark. When I say fraud on the market, what does that mean to you? What does it mean to you based on the Basic versus Levinson case? So it doesn't mean a lot to you. Okay, we'll come back to you on Monday. That's great news. Back to the back of cards. You will be, oh, Chris Hunt. I knew that. That's you. Just moved back in with my parents. Oh, my God. One guy lives with his parents, he's out, you're in. What are the odds of that? That is great news. It was meant to be. Chris, when I say fraud on the market to you, does it mean anything to you?
Well, in the open market, the price of a company's stock is determined by all available information. There's fraud, the company's value is not defined anyway.
Okay, what does it mean to you based on Basic versus Levinson?
That misleading statements will afford purchases of stocks even if they do not rely on the suit.
Okay, so let's characterize it as a doctrine. Is it a presumption?
Yes.
Okay, is it a rebuttable presumption?
Yes.
Okay.
The respondents relied on that. It creates the presumption that the respondents relied on that, which should be a misrepresentation.
Okay, so we have a misrepresentation out in the market that has been incorporated into the price of the stock. When somebody buys that stock and that misinformation is out there, we presume that they bought relying on that misinformation. Does that make sense? So fraud on the market says that it's a rebuttable presumption that you relied on the integrity of the market price. You believed it to be true. There's an open and developed securities market. You don't need to see or individually rely on the misstatement. You don't even need to know that it happened. You need to buy in a securities market where that information is out there. You are presumed to have relied on it. That's fantastic for plaintiffs, right? Because it gets you over the reliance piece. So fraud on the market is a rebuttable presumption. For you?
I want to call it a rebuttable presumption that you rely on.
On the integrity of the market price. So it obviates the need to rely on the misstatement. So instead of saying, I relied on that misstatement, you say, that misstatement existed publicly, I bought in a securities market, therefore I am presumed to have relied on it. So this is bootstrapping. It's giving plaintiffs a jump over reliance at the expense of the company. Who are we going to protect? The company that allowed the misstatement to be out there, or the innocent investor? We're going to balance out the equities. So it's invoked when we have an efficient market and a material misrepresentation. Those of you who studied economics or who will go on to study economics will no doubt come across the efficient capital markets theory, which is this idea that information gets sucked into the price of stock and that there's varying degrees of efficiency. Some people believe the market picks up everything. Some people believe the market picks up nothing. But the concept here, except to the dissent, is that the market internalizes information. And so if a misstatement is out there, it gets built into the price of the stock. So when you buy the stock, you have suffered because you paid too much for it. Does that make sense to everybody? The misstatement is out there, and if you knew about it, if everybody really knew about it, the stock price would have gone down. But the misstatement is out, if everybody knew the misstatement was wrong, right? But it's out there as a fact, it gets built into the price, everybody thinks the price is where it should be, but there's a lie built in there. So we're assuming that when you bought the stock, you were relying on that lie. So it's rebuttable presumption. Now how can the defendant rebut the presumption? Market not deceived, corrective statement, specific plaintiff would have sold anyway. Eric, what do you think? Why don't you pick one of those and walk us through it? How can the defendant sever the link between the misrepresentation and the price of the stock?
The defendant can sever the link between the misrepresentation and the price by using the materiality.
Okay, so they can show that the misrepresentation was not material, but let's say that it was material. And you're being sued and you want to say you can't use fraud on the market. Would it make a difference to you if you could show that the market didn't believe the misrepresentation?
Yes, because if the market doesn't believe it, then the investor shouldn't believe the misrepresentation.
Exactly. Think ahead to Basic versus Levinson, where they kept saying, we're not merging. And every time they said that, the stock jumped, as if they were merging. The market didn't believe the denials. So if you can show, based on whatever anecdotal evidence you can put up, that the market was not deceived, then it's not fair to say that the plaintiff gets to rely on it. The reason we were letting the plaintiff rely on it was because the market was deceived. The market believed the misstatement, and it got fed into the price of the stock that our poor plaintiff bought. But if the market didn't believe it, it didn't get incorporated into the stock. The plaintiff paid the correct price, and does not get the benefit of the presumption. Does that make sense? That's severing the link. So my affirmative defense to a fraud on the market charge is the market was not deceived. How about a corrective statement? Chris, what about a corrective statement?
Well, pretty much just take some money right out of their sales that they received quite a company that has picked up on that some information they had let out was
so after the corrective statement, you can't be brought on the market anymore. What corrective statements don't do is they don't look backwards. They don't fix the time period before the corrective statement, right? So your plaintiffs can still use fraud on the market for any purchases or sales up until the corrective statement. Once the corrective statement is out there, the market internalizes that, the price adjusts, probably downward, and our plaintiff that buys the corrected price loses the ability to sue. They lose the presumption over reliance. So the second way to sever the link is to issue a corrective statement. It's not as complete as market not being deceived, because it divides the world into two time frames. Before the corrective statement and after the corrective. It's better than nothing. What's the downside to a corrective statement, my cynical friends? Adam?
I mean, you may be getting yourself in trouble.
You think? Because you're standing up there and going, okay, what we said before, not true. Not true. So then all the people that were going to sue you, Exhibit A, is you saying, not true, right? The corrective statement fixes you going forward. That's a calculated risk. The corporate lawyers don't do that. The litigators help us with that. Once you know the information is wrong, under the securities laws, you have an obligation to disclose it. It creates some problems for your litigation posture going forward. I had a hand over here. No. Yes. Erica.
I think corrective statements also open the door whether it also opens the door whether it's read it or not, or where you put it, or what they're really supposed to that person type of people, or everything like that, so it might not end up being a corrective statement.
The jury will get into all of that, but we live in this area with respect to this presumption. We live in a mythical world of efficient markets. What we're going to see in Texas Gulf Sulphur is, when does something become public? Now everything's on the internet in 5 seconds. The Dow Jones has a tape. There are lots of ways that you can measure what's public. But something that's been publicly released, that's going to count as informing the market, whether we read it or not. But those kinds of issues, the jury is really going to be concerned. The corrective disclosure severs the link, but it does create some other issues. What if you could show the specific plaintiff would have sold anyway? Sarah, why would the specific plaintiff have sold anyway?
I don't know, maybe they had other reasons up there.
Maybe their daughter was getting married and they needed 20 grand, right? Maybe the IRS was going to foreclose on their house. Maybe, regardless of, there are some people that are strategic investors that sell only at the perfect moment in time. They have a lot of money, right? The rest of us, we sell if it's the perfect time or if we need money. For example, if Hofstra Law School sends you an email saying, please pay your tuition, you would send, you might have to liquidate some of your portfolio to take care of that, assuming that you had a portfolio. So that kind of thing is going to play in here. There may be specific evidence about why this plaintiff would have sold anyway. That's a gross lawsuit, right? Yeah.
As far as this fraud on the market theory goes, doesn't it apply to a class?
It can.
But it doesn't have to.
It can be an individual. If you can certify a class, it helps you certify a class. The reason it helps you is if you couldn't use the presumption to get a class action together, you'd have to show that everybody relied. And that's a lot of proof. So this helps you get a class together.
If you had a class and you show that specific plaintiffs would have sold anyway, it probably wouldn't.
It's going to cut them out of the class.
Oh, okay.
They're going to come out of the class. What I was starting to say was the specific plaintiffs would have sold anyway, that's a gross lawsuit, right? If somebody's sick or needed the money for some reason, for you to say, you claim this, but isn't it true? And then you get in their financial records and think about all the stuff you could get from discovery. That's going to be an unpleasant lawsuit. But then again, they started it. They sued you. So, Chris?
If I read this, the way I read it was that mergers are too speculative sometimes. It may not impact the market.
Mergers are too speculative, deals with the materiality, and we're going to save that concept and come back to it. Or maybe we're going to come back to it right this second now that I think about it. Causation. You have to show that the misstatement caused the damage. Fraud on the market helps you with both reliance and with causation. Scienter is required for 10B. The plaintiff has to show that you knew or should have known of the mistake. If you think back to our president and vice president of the bowling alley, you said, we're too dumb, we didn't know what was in here, that's not going to help. That would count as scienter. You knew or should have known. Negligence is not going to be enough. Some courts say recklessness is, but usually you really need an intent to deceive. Okay, Chris, getting back to basic versus legacy. Why don't you tell us about these denials and about the unrequited love that combustion had for basic. It's really a love story. This case is really a love story.
Well, combustion wanted to acquire them earlier in 65.
And why didn't they?
I don't know what it was antitrust concerns. I don't know what they are, but they must have been subject to counseling by the government.
They didn't do it because they couldn't do it, right? There were antitrust. I don't know, have you guys taken antitrust? There are rules against who can combine and how big an enterprise can get. We have a very strong pro-competition public policy in this country. The FTC gets involved. The Justice Department gets involved on various mergers. And these guys were prohibited. They would have had too much of the market. Under the landscape that they were seeking to do the merger in, they were not allowed to do it. But as soon as they could, what did they do?
They came up with a quote-unquote plan to strategy to acquire them for $30 million.
Okay.
And they had started to have meetings and discussions about it secretly or in a confidential.
Right. They weren't that secret though, right?
Right.
If you ever try to keep a secret, it's really, really hard. And when you think about the efficient market, and, you know, you guys remember the movie Working Girl? Did you guys see that? Are you too young for that? Melanie Griffith? She is this Staten Island secretary who figures all this stuff out. She brings a page six clip in, and she brings all this information together and puts it all together. When you see people having lunch that don't belong having lunch, it gets reported in the newspaper. It could be that their pals and their kids go to school together, or it could be that they're secretly plotting a merger. We hope that if they're secretly plotting a merger, they might not do it at the Plaza Hotel, but we don't know. That kind of stuff gets reported and the market goes crazy. So their secret meetings turned out to be not that secret. People started finding out about it. How do we know that people started finding out about it? What was happening to the stock?
Yeah, there was an increase in the trading volume and activity on the, I think it was the New York Stock Exchange.
Yep, it was abnormally high trading. The stock exchange, you never got a bigger bunch of nerds, right? They have data all day long. When they say something is abnormally heavy, believe me, they have the backup for it. They study the volume of this, that, and the other thing, and combinations and permutations, and they said, something is going on here. Now, sometimes abnormally high trading is just abnormally high trading, but there was all this history of them seeking to acquire BASIC. So we have abnormally high trading. The investors are circulating rumors, and BASIC denied them. On October 21st, they say, no negotiations are underway. September 25th, the New York Stock Exchange drops them a line and says, what on earth is going on with this abnormally high trading? And they say, management is unaware of any present or pending development to explain the abnormally high stock activity. Except for the fact that they were having secret meetings while they were saying that, it's a little bit problematic. Then in November, they send a report to the shareholders that says they remain unaware. Okay. On December 18th, BASIC asks New York Stock Exchange to suspend their trading and announces they've been approached with a merger. Okay. They were approached months before, but approached nonetheless. On December 19th, the board approves it, and they publicly announce it. So who are our shareholders? Eric, who are our shareholders? Yeah, I'm sorry, who are our plaintiffs? Why am I wondering why I meant to say, who are our plaintiffs?
Plaintiffs are several shareholders sold this on briefly before the announcement, the official announcement of the merger.
So what's our time frame for viable plaintiffs here?
Between when the second rumor was denied and the announcement of the merger.
The announcement of the merger is going to be the end date. That operates as almost a corrective statement, right? As we were just talking about. So anybody who buys after the announcement is on their own, the theory being that the announcement will build into the price of the stock. Where should we start it? Chris, where do you want to start it?
I would like to start after the first denial.
The day of the first denial. As soon as that denial goes out to the public, the market has been informed of that. Anybody who buys or sells stock during that time period did so at a disadvantage, right? Because there was information about mergers out there that were not reported. They were denied. So the plaintiffs claim that they would have gotten higher prices when they sold if BASIC had not issued the denials. That's their argument. So they bring a class action. This is what Sarah was asking about. They bring a class action saying, you violated 10B, you violated 10b-5. We were injured by selling our shares in this depressed market when the shares should have been worth so much more if everybody really knew about the merger. And we suffered because of your misleading and incorrect statements. Now, why do you think, Chris, that BASIC denied the rumors?
They probably were denying them because as saying that mergers...
So now I think that's confusing. Maybe they knew that, but...
Tend to be a bit volatile and they didn't know if it was going to really go through, and that's why they were trying to press the Third Circuit test for the agreement in principle of defense, that they had some sort of agreement reached between them on how they actually announced it, because it could have gone the other way, and if they announced it to
Without a doubt, and they would have also had some job problems keeping their officer and director gigs, right? The agreement in principle test that the Third Circuit used before BASIC said, this becomes material. You only have to disclose something if it's material. That's what this fight is about, guys. The fight is about whether preliminary merger discussions are important enough to go to the world. Whether failure to disclose preliminary merger talks is a material omission. That's really what we're looking at. Does that make sense as the issue? Whether the failure to disclose preliminary merger talks is material. Because if it's immaterial, the fact that they didn't disclose it doesn't matter. But if it is material and they fail to disclose it, fraud on the market, which the Supreme Court validates in this case, is going to allow the group of people we talked about between the first denial and the corrective disclosure, the announcement of the merger, those guys are going to have a cause of action. They probably kept it secret. Also, people are superstitious. You don't want to have other people in your business. They also really wanted to do the deal between the two of them. And they were concerned that if there was public information about the deal, a third party might come in. And if the third party offered a sweeter deal, the shareholders of BASIC might go for it. So they kind of wanted to keep it to themselves, maybe because of the preliminary nature, maybe just to avoid somebody else coming in. But they decided for business reasons to try to keep it secret. It turned out they weren't very good at that, but they did try. And they didn't want competitive bidders to be in there. Okay, the district court certifies the class. They adopt the presumption of reliance. This is the beginning of fraud on the market. They say the petitioner's public statements enabled the court to conclude that we had a class. Everybody suffered enough similarly that we could certify the class. But they found on the merits that it wasn't material. So that's not a good day. Yet, congratulations, your class is certified. Sorry to tell you, your case is dismissed. They thought the misstatements were immaterial because at the exact moment of the first denial, there happened to be no negotiations. And then they said, with respect to the second and third denials, the negotiations were not destined with reasonable certainty to become a merger in principle, which gets us to the test that Chris was talking about, the agreement in principle test. The Sixth Circuit takes a different look at it and says, we're going to start fraud on the market. We're going to adopt fraud on the market. It's a rebuttable presumption that our petitioners relied on the omission. They relied on the material misrepresentation in the form of an omission, and they reversed and remanded. We see from the Sixth Circuit opinion, you have a little bit of it in your Supreme Court opinion, the idea that if you don't have a duty to disclose, if you don't have a duty to speak, and you do speak, you must speak truthfully. We're going to see that in a bunch of the cases. Martha Stewart would not have gone to jail if she kept her mouth shut. She didn't violate the securities law. She impeded an investigation. If she simply said no comment or smiled that beautiful smile, she would not have gone to jail. When you speak, you must speak truthfully. If you have a duty to speak, you got to speak. But if you have no duty to speak and you choose to speak, you better speak truthfully. And when they said a denial, they were not speaking truthfully. We're going to pause after this slide, but what we're getting at here is the concept of a standard of materiality. As Sarah told us, it's complicated to pick a fixed point of what's material, because we don't want to make it too high, make too high a standard, because then we'll miss things that are important. We don't want to make it too low, because it'll bog down the courts. TSC Industries, a case we're not reading, has a very well-defined and very commonly adopted standard of materiality. Is there a substantial likelihood that a reasonable shareholder would consider the fact important? If the answer to that is yes, you should disclose it. If the answer to that is no, it's probably not material. What I'm going to leave you with and what we're going to pick up with on Monday is, how do you factor in something like a preliminary merger agreement that might or might not happen? If it happens, it would be a big deal. So what we're going to look at is the balancing test. What is the probability that it's going to happen? And if it happened, how big a deal would it be? If it was very likely to be a big deal, it's material. If it's very unlikely and wouldn't be a big deal, it's immaterial. The fun is in the middle. I will see you on Monday.
Don't log out though.